Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on the budget that Congress recently passed and its impact on our society, on the wealthy, the poor, and all of us in between. But budgets are not just about dollars and cents. They're also about values, what we stand for as a people, our sense of responsibility to one another and to our shared future. Few people are better prepared to talk about this subject than Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, now at Cal Berkeley. Joining him is Greg Ipp, Chief Economics Commentator for the Wall Street Journal. Moderating this program is Ray Suarez. This program is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
Well, gentlemen, by passing a tax bill, you're not only making a decision about how government collects money, you're implicitly and explicitly rewarding some economic behavior, discouraging others. And similarly, when you pass a budget, a spending plan, that's a political document as well. It puts the administration that proposes and the Congress that disposes on record. This is what we think is important. Robert Reich, what are the priorities that you see in our budget proposals?
Well, the priorities ought to be to help people get ahead, that is, education, job training, also to invest in our productive capacities as human beings through healthcare, through the ability of people to make the most of themselves, even if they are not fully healthy, equal protection of the laws, equal opportunity. It seems to me that our most basic responsibility as members of the same society is to join together and to support the capacities of each of us as individuals to their fullest.
And do you see that in the White House's budget proposal for 2018-19?
I see just the opposite. I see major cuts in programs that have been at least minimally necessary for helping people to go forward. There are, in fact, even cuts in Medicaid. There are prospective cuts in Medicare. There are cuts in all sorts of individual programs that have been very, very important in terms of investments in people, in education. The tax bill already reduced taxes dramatically on corporations and on the wealthy. Adding in these budget cuts in investments, public investments, in the capacities of people to basically get what they need in terms of healthcare and opportunity, I think puts the nation back to the years it was before the New Deal.
Greg Ipp, when you look at the spending proposals, what would you direct our attention to?
What I think is interesting is that historically, we could have said the two parties in the United States had two different approaches to budgeting. Republicans preferred small government, so less taxes and less spending. Democrats preferred larger government, so more spending and taxes commensurate with the higher level of spending. Under Trump, we have actually an unusual amalgam. He sticks with the Republican preference for lower taxes, which is why he signed a tax bill that cut tax revenue by more than $1 trillion over 10 years. But then he presents a budget where at least two-thirds of spending is off limits, and that two-thirds includes programs for the elderly, such as Medicare and Social Security, plus Homeland Security, veterans, and defense. And what that essentially means is that to have any semblance whatsoever of making the books balance, they have to go after everything else with a broad axe. And that includes some of the safety net programs that Dr. Reich was just referring to. And it includes other things like the whole area of discretionary spending, which essentially means everything except for spending on the elderly and defense. It means environmental protection. It means research. It means education. And under their proposal, just in the next year or two, that portion of the budget, what we budget wonks call discretionary domestic spending, would fall to its lowest in over 50 years. And yet, even with those cuts, if you use anything approaching plausible assumptions about how fast the economy will grow, we're still left with very large deficits.
Well, Greg, if the society doesn't stand still and remain a static variable while politicians wrangle over these things, aren't we on the verge of a set of years where some of these budget items are just going to be more expensive because Americans are getting older and we've got a big generation aging into some of its highest need years.
You're exactly right, Ray. I mean, the two largest, together, the single largest lump of spending in the federal budget is the so-called mandatory programs, which are the big three are Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. And those first two, Medicare and Social Security, are, even if you make no changes whatsoever to the rules governing those budgets, they're going to consume ever more of a portion of our national resources just because the population is aging and most years health care gets more expensive. And yet we really haven't seen any sort of concrete proposals yet to rein that in. In fact, Donald Trump campaigned very much on a platform of saying, I'm not going to touch your Medicare and I'm not going to touch your Social Security, partly because he drew so much support from elderly, primarily white voters. Now, if you look in the budget that his budget director presented a few weeks ago, there are some savings proposed for Medicare. And to be honest, some of them actually make good sense. He wants Medicare to be a little bit tougher in terms of dealing with things like bad debts. But interestingly enough, when Barack Obama proposed many of exactly these same things while he was president, he could not get Congress to agree to them, partly because the provider lobby and the elderly lobby was very resistant to them. And so, notwithstanding the good intentions of putting these in the budget, if you do not have strong political and presidential commitment behind them, they're not going to happen.
Robert Reich, what happens? You've been to this movie before. When the assumptions are flawed, when the money is not going to cover the obligations that have been set forth by the government, what happens?
Well, the sad thing is, Ray, that nothing happens. I mean, we've not had budgets for some time now coming from the White House that have been anything more alive than, well, dead on arrival. And the Trump budget looks like it's going to be exactly the same, except with regard to two items that Congress is, I think, quite interested in. One, and there is bipartisan interest in this, and that is infrastructure. Unfortunately, Trump has not talked about exactly how he's going to pay for his big infrastructure plan, and the budget doesn't really reflect what he has talked about. But nevertheless, there's a lot of support for doing something. Everybody knows that the infrastructure of America needs a great deal of attention. The second area where there is a great deal of Republican support, and Trump is quite insistent on this, is to increase the military budget substantially. One of the largest increases percentage-wise in the military budget we've seen over the last 20 years. Not clear exactly why. The case has not been made very, very firmly and succinctly what is going to be in that military budget and why, given all of the waste that we've seen in the realm of military contracts over the last several decades, why that is so essential. And given that also that the United States military budget is also larger than the military budgets of the next six largest militaries in the world. Nonetheless, the Republicans seem quite intent on doing that, which is going to put, as Greg said, even more pressure on the rest of the budget, unless we are going to see just huge and quite dramatic and not sustainable increases in the budget deficit and the resulting debt.
Well, look, budgets and spending proposals are freighted with symbolism along with actual numbers and actual goals. That's part of the schematic that Greg laid out at the beginning about the general tendencies of Democrats and Republicans. Republicans are on record almost always wanting larger military budgets. It looks like they're going to get it, no?
Yes. In fact, it looks like they already did get it. I mean, back in 2011, a Republican Congress forced President Obama to accept very tight caps on discretionary and defense spending. Well, we've now basically blown off those caps, and so there was a significant increase in defense and domestic spending agreed to just a few weeks ago, which in some sense made this budget not just dead on arrival, but dead before arrival. But I think it still sort of raises significant questions about the future. Having agreed to these fairly easy decisions, okay, Republicans, you get your more increased defense spending. Democrats, you get your increased domestic spending. There is no overarching vision about how that make the numbers add up. We have just passed this very large and expensive permanent tax cut. And as a consequence, budget deficits are going to balloon in coming years, which is virtually unprecedented outside of a recession.
What happens when that happens? Greg, you've written for years about the way money moves around and what happens when it's in plentiful supply, what happens when it's in short supply. Let's talk a little bit about the mechanics. You've just laid out a scenario where we're simply not going to be able to pay our bills. What happens?
So the federal debt is already extremely large at around 75% of gross domestic product, closing in on 80%. And if you make some reasonable assumptions about what these spending and tax proposals do, it'll be headed over 100%, which may be the highest we've seen since the Second World War. And we haven't got a lot of experience dealing with debts of these size. Now, periodically, you will hear people say, well, countries that run debts of that size, they have a crisis and then everything goes to heck. But that's not really true of countries that control their own currency, much less the world's most preferred reserve currencies, which what the United States has. So there really isn't much doubt that we can continue to borrow for quite a while, that the rest of the world will give us plenty of rope to hang ourselves with. And besides, we seem to be in a world where interest rates are unusually low just because, irrespective of how much the government is borrowing, everybody else, whether it's corporations or the Chinese, seems to want to save. So the United States, notwithstanding these very serious deficits, continues to borrow at extremely low rates. But what we have discovered is that even when the country can still borrow, when you go into a recession and the deficit starts to balloon, there's enormous political pressure to contain that cost. Christy Romer, one of Dr. Rush's former colleagues at Berkeley University, has recently done a paper that shows exactly that, is that countries with high debts face very large, very intense political pressure to cut spending and raise taxes during recessions, which, of course, just makes the recession worse. And so I think that if steps are not taken in the next few years to basically begin to close this structural budget gap, we will see that again in the next recession, and there will be another recession.
Dr. Reich, at the outset of our conversation, you talked about preferable spending priorities. If you assume that we were going to run a deficit one way or the other, is it better, is it preferable to borrow money to build a destroyer or borrow money to pay your education bills or your social welfare bills? What ends up having a multiplier effect in the economy?
Well, if you're in the middle of the Second World War, Ray, you've got to borrow in order to undertake your war, to prosecute your war. You don't have much choice. If you're already sitting on top of a huge military, and although it's not peacetime, there's not a world war, and you do want to grow your economy and lower your debt as a percentage of the total economy, and the best way and easiest way of doing that is to grow the economy, then you want to use your spending as investing. That is, you want to invest in ways that will help increase productivity and grow the economy over time. I'm talking about education primarily. You want better schools. You want better access to higher education and technical education, lifelong education. You want to make sure that your public transportation and your private transportation systems, your infrastructure, your water treatment systems are all in good condition. That also helps productivity. And finally, productivity also depends, as I said at the outset, on healthy people. You want to make sure that your people, not just as a matter of being generous to people, but in terms of your actual economic productivity, you want to make sure that people are healthy, that they are able to come to work and able to be productive in even the most basic senses of the term. I should add that these are not entirely separate bins. That is, a child, a small child who is not adequately nourished cannot go to school and learn, or a child who does not receive adequate medical treatment, or who can't see the blackboard because has not had adequate optometrist, or not seen an eye doctor, obviously cannot learn. So you can't separate these entirely. That's why I think investments in people and investments in infrastructure are the most important things we can do to grow the economy.
Again, we're going to borrow money either way. Should we prioritize those expenditures that you were just talking about over the shipyard workers, the welders, the people making roll steel? They get jobs out of that destroyer too, don't they?
They would get jobs out of the destroyer. They also get jobs out of healthcare and education and a lot of other things we could do. But of the two areas, assuming we are basically at peace, out of the two large categories that we're talking about, either military expenditures or investing in health and education, what you want to do to build the economy is to invest in your people, because that's the way ultimately productivity is improved, and it's through productivity improvements that you grow your economy. And that, by the way, I want to emphasize, that may be based on borrowing if you have to borrow, but it does pay back a big, big return in terms of economic growth, which reduces your debt as a proportion of the total economy.
Greg, Secretary Reich brings up productivity, and certainly that's an important variable, an important metric in assessing any economic activity. But, you know, as I look over charts from the last 30 and 40 years, productivity and wages have long since parted company. American workers were creating more value added per hour year after year after year and not enjoying commensurate wages. Those two lines widened and widened and widened, and now they're totally estranged from each other.
Yes, it's true. We did begin to see in the early 1980s a divergence between these two trends. Historically, the median wage of a worker in the United States was closely linked to how productive that worker was. And as you say, those lines started to part in the early 1980s. But something else also went on, which is that the actual rate of productivity growth itself also declined. So if productivity had kept growing at its prior rate, wages probably would have done better, even if perhaps not as well as they would have if inequality had not widened. Now, the causes of that inequality are, there's many of them, and we could spend another hour talking about those. But let's talk a little bit about how the budget choices that we make affect those trends. Most economists will tell you that there's very little the government can do, certainly in the short term, that affects the long-term trend of productivity. A lot of that has to do with these serendipitous discoveries that our innovators and our entrepreneurs come up with and how fast they diffuse through the economy. And maybe one of the reasons productivity growth is slow right now is that all of our best ideas have already been discovered. But that said, there are certain things you can do. And it's not always a matter of just spending more money, but how you spend it. So, for example, not all infrastructure dollars are created equal. A dollar spent to build a highway in a empty rural part of the country will not contribute to national productivity as much as a highway built in a busy urban area with a lot of congestion and people losing lots and lots of hours because of traffic jams. So to the extent that the government can find more effective ways to deliver these services, that's kind of like picking up $20 bills on the sidewalk. And the Trump administration has some very good ideas about how to speed up approval of major infrastructure projects. This would, if it actually works, would be one way of boosting the productivity potential of the country for a relatively modest cost. But at the end of the day, it is still the case that a lot of things that you want the federal government to invest in, because those things are uniquely suited to the government, like education, like basic research, do cost money. And then you're back to this question of, well, will it be guns or will it be butter? Do we invest in ways to make our military more effective, or ways to make, say, agriculture more productive? And you can easily say that this is simply a matter of setting national priorities. Maybe we are at a time when we want the military to project more power. The world seems like a dangerous place. North Korea is acquiring nuclear weapons. Perhaps of all the many things and priorities facing our country, that should be the priority right now, and something else has to take a backseat. But there's another choice, too. We could have both guns and butter, provided we're willing to pay for it. And that requires somebody paying higher taxes. We know now that not only does the current Congress and the current president believe that Americans should not pay higher taxes, they should actually pay lower taxes. But frankly, after 8 years, Barack Obama had a hard time persuading anybody to pay higher taxes. He got the 1 or 2% richest families to pay more tax, but his administration and his party was very, you know, much opposed to raising taxes on 90% of families. So I would say that we can have all the priorities we want as long as we're willing to pay for them. And I just don't see many people out there telling folks the hard truth that somebody at some point is going to have to pay for all these priorities.
Secretary Reich, how should we regard deficits? Depending on the economist you're reading, some say, oh, well, right now it's a controllable, manageable percentage of our overall economy. You know, they may wish that it was a little lower, but aren't ringing the alarm bells yet. You're talking about the needs that aren't being met. How should we regard deficit spending right now?
Well, again, it's what you spend what you're borrowing on. That is, any family knows that borrowing money and going on a world cruise with that money is less responsible than borrowing money to help your child get a college education, because the child's education is going to help the child do better and be more productive, and that's the right kind of borrowing. So too with a nation. If we use our borrowing to invest in people, in infrastructure, in basic research and development, that's good borrowing in the sense that it helps us be more productive and grow overall.
But isn't there a threshold? Isn't there a line that you cross where you start to say, you know, even though that is worthwhile spending, even laudable spending, we just can't do it now because we've already borrowed too much money? Or if it's for investment in human capital that does pay back down the road, you're willing to countenance larger long-term deficits.
I think you regard it the way you regard any private investment. That is, you try to find out what the return on that investment is. We know, for example, early childhood education, that would be preschool and even children before preschool, who get a lot of attention and stimulus who would not otherwise get it at home because home, well, the people are off working at home. That pays off in terms of children who later are better able to learn, who have jobs and stick to those jobs and learn and earn more in those jobs. We know that preschool and early childhood education, therefore, is the kind of investment that if we borrowed for, would more than pay for. The return is very, very large over a child's life. And multiply that over the entire population of very, very young children who could really use that and profit by it and become much more productive because of it, that's the kind of investment we definitely should borrow for. Because that, you see, will actually reduce the total debt as a percentage of the national economy, even though in absolute terms the debt would be getting larger. If you look at the debt as a percentage of the economy, it would be getting smaller because the economy would be getting larger given these kinds of investments, early childhood or infrastructure or education generally, or, and this requires a little bit more of a discussion, healthcare.
Greg Ip, would you answer that question the same way, that because there are paybacks down the road, you can see investment in human capital short-term as having long-term payoffs, even if you have to borrow money for it now?
I think you need to be very careful at distinguishing that there are different types of capital, both human and physical capital, and their payoff rates are different. I would be hesitant to, you know, justify borrowing a lot today on the presumption that it'll pay for itself later on, because I don't think the evidence is terribly persuasive on that front. Just to take one example, physical infrastructure. If you build a museum or a park, that pays benefits in terms of making our lives better, but it doesn't pay an economic return, and you can't really tax, you know, a happy day out with the family in order to pay for the investment later on. So you have to be very scrupulous in evaluating the potential of these various investments to pay for themselves. And to repeat the point I made a little bit earlier, there may be ways to achieve the human capital improvements that Secretary Reich was talking about without spending a lot of money. There might be ways to improve outcomes in the education system and the healthcare system. To give one example, some research has found that in Minnesota, they achieve the same healthcare outcomes for one-third of the cost that they do in Florida. Surely there must be ways to learn from what Minnesota does and share that information with other states. And similarly with education, the evidence that spending more money on early childhood education generates better outcomes in the future. Yes, those outcomes do in general arrive, but there's a very large spread in results and quite a few different models to pursue that. So I would still say that at the end of the day, you're better off for most of these things agreeing to pay the taxes now for the expenditure now. That's the more prudent approach. Now, I'd make an exception for a couple things. First of all, it depends on what the state of the economy is. The case for deficit spending is very different when you're deep in a recession, the unemployment rate is 8 or 9%, than when you're in a booming economy as we are today when it's 4%. When you're in a recession, if you want to borrow money to build highways or build destroyers, there's a lot of unemployed people and idle shipyards and factories waiting for orders to arrive. And you really don't have to put any strain on the economy to get them to deliver those goods and services. And so that can actually put people back to work at very little cost. When you're at a full employment economy like now, the hard truth is that if we were to spend a lot of money, you know, building destroyers or building highways, we'd end up taking workers away from something else because there are so few unemployed workers available. Hard to believe as it is. And in order to do that, we'd have to sort of bid up wages, and their employers would have to like raise the prices that they charge. You'd end up with inflation. The Federal Reserve would respond to that by raising interest rates. Higher interest rates would make it less attractive for private companies to invest. You get what it's called crowding out. So I think making the case for deficit spending depends heavily on where you are in the cycle. And most economists would believe that the case for deficit spending or, you know, deficit finance tax cuts today is very, very weak because we are at such a low unemployment rate and because the Federal Reserve is now raising interest rates. And if you pile a lot more fiscal stimulus into this economy, you might juice up inflation pressure and prompt the Fed to raise interest rates even faster.
So far, gentlemen, we've been looking inward, from the United States inward, at ourselves, at our priorities, at what we might stress as we look at our priorities at home. Let's turn the lens and look out. The budgets that are being contemplated currently look for cuts in the budget for the State Department, for overseas diplomatic missions, for the number of staff working in our overseas missions. They are also contemplating currently the administration increases in tariffs on steel and aluminum, already announced tariff increases for solar panels. What do the priorities of the Trump administration say to the rest of the world about what we want to see? Robert Reich?
Well, I'm afraid they say to the rest of the world that we're not very much interested in the rest of the world, that making America great is the equivalent to, at least in the administration's eyes, making America number one. And there's a kind of zero-sum thinking coming from the White House in the sense that our advances and our successes come at the expense of somebody else, just as their gains would come at our expense. I think this is very dangerous, quite frankly. I don't think that the world is a zero-sum game. I think it has been a positive-sum game in the sense that we can and must advance together, not only by cutting the State Department personnel and diplomatic missions, by putting up obstacles to trade, but also getting out of the Paris Accords and turning our backs on the environment and efforts that other countries are making to control pollution and CO2 emissions. We are, in effect, saying to the rest of the world in a very dangerous way, there is no leadership in the world. And we are not going to be that leader, and we frankly don't care much about you.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales. We're hearing from Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, now at Cal Berkeley. Joining him is Greg Ipp. He's chief economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal. During this broadcast, our listeners are experiencing our format change, and that is that we've invited two veteran reporters to join me as co-hosts of World Affairs. Ray is known to our listeners as the former chief national correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. He was also anchor of NPR's Talk of the Nation. Ray is a great journalist and a good friend. And joining Ray and me as co-host will be Marcos Kounoulakis. Marcos is a former Newsweek reporter, and he's now at Stanford's Hoover Institution. We'll be handing off moderator responsibilities among us, and at times we'll appear together to share our observations of issues in the news. We hope you will join us in these conversations. If you do, you'll help ensure that they're conversations that matter. And now back to our program.
Greg Ipp, the president has also threatened cuts in foreign aid. I think perhaps working off the public's impression that it's a big part of American spending. It's not really, but highly symbolic, no?
It's highly symbolic, but it's also quite tiny. Look, I think there might be a danger in trying to extract an overarching and internally consistent worldview by looking at these various initiatives of the administration. There's a lot of back and forth, a lot of sort of different views, a lot of sort of tension actually within the administration about where to go. And the results you see are not necessarily the consequence of a single unified process. So the cuts to foreign aid and State Department, coming at the same time that they're vastly increasing the military spend, are actually speaking to almost diametrically opposed views about the U.S. role in the world. On the one hand, less soft power through State Department and foreign aid, more hard power through military. But they do not together speak to like a larger or smaller role for the United States. I think more accurately, they just speak to an absence of a unified vision about how the United States should approach the world. You mentioned the increased tariffs. So, yes, Donald Trump has on Thursday announced higher tariffs on aluminum and steel. He's previously announced tariffs on washing machines and solar panels. He wants to get very tough with countries that he says have been taking advantage of the United States for many years. Now, in and of itself, that is not a statement about the United States turning its back on the world. There are many examples of other countries rampantly abusing the free market process, and many people on all sides of the debate agree that China's behavior, for example, in particular with intellectual property theft, is especially egregious and needs to be dealt with. I think you go back to the 1980s, for example, Ronald Reagan, a very conservative president who was very much in favor of a highly engaged United States on the global stage. He too, you know, took some pretty aggressive protectionist action against countries like Japan in terms of voluntary export restraints and so forth. I think what sets Donald Trump apart is that, first of all, unlike Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump is not a free trader at heart. He does not fundamentally believe that free trade is a positive sum game. He has said many times that essentially winning means having a trade surplus, losing means having a trade deficit. No economist thinks of it that way. And so the other thing is that there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to the way he approaches this trade thing. So he's raised tariffs on aluminum and steel, even though there isn't a demonstrable case that the companies importing aluminum steel have broken any trade laws. Instead, he's citing national security. The United States needs an aluminum and a steel industry in order to be secure. And this comes after years of the United States criticizing China for using national security as an excuse for its own protectionist actions. Moreover, these tariffs are going to inflame relationships between the United States and some of its closest allies, countries like Canada, Mexico, Western Europe, Japan. These are countries that the United States would normally look to for support in terms of building alliances on the world stage for, you know, for example, confronting a rising China. In that regard, this administration's trade policy, I think, creates more risks and more tensions with foreign policy than has been the case in a long time.
Help me out here, Greg Ipp. If the United States says to Korea, look, we don't want as many of those LG washing machines. Is a GE worker or a Maytag or a Mana worker going to get another hour of labor on the line in Louisville or somewhere in Indiana or in Chicago?
Well, I don't think a GE worker would, because correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think GE makes those appliances any longer. Whirlpool does. And yes, I do think that in the short term, because the competitors' products are more expensive, that will increase the market share for domestically made machines, and therefore some domestic manufacturing workers will get more hours and more pay. But remember, the money that goes into their pockets came out of the pockets of consumers who are now paying more for washing machines. And because they're paying more for washing machines, they will have less money to spend on other things, whether it's ballet lessons for their children or trips to Disneyland. And so therefore, the jobs that we deliver to those manufacturing workers are at the expense of other workers. And at the end of the day, we can't create more jobs than we have people to do those jobs. And what we end up in a world where we insist on making everything at home, and therefore we insist that Japan make everything at home, is that everything is more expensive and that we collectively as a society are poorer.
Greg Ip, I guess it even depends on which Donald Trump you're talking about. Donald Trump, before he was licensing his name and when he was actually building buildings and hotels, might have had his people on the telephone raging about the more expensive imported steel because he was using it in his buildings. Donald Trump, the president of the United States, is now putting tariffs on some of that same steel that he was using to build his real estate empire.
Well, I would actually say that trade is that perhaps the only area where Donald Trump has been consistent throughout his public life. You go back to the 1980s, and he was accusing Japan of ripping off the United States, and he was calling for protectionist moves to protect American manufacturers. Have some of his companies use those cheap imports? Well, yeah, but a businessman is meant to maximize profits, and I don't think that should necessarily be held against him when, as president of the United States, he undertakes policies that he thinks are better for the country as a whole. And so this is not a new thing for him. He has long felt quite strongly that the United States is being ripped off, that we need to get tougher with other countries. And by the way, he's not the only one. You have a lot of people in both parties who, especially with respect to China, do feel that the United States has been systematically hurt and taken advantage of. And so there's a lot of support in both parties for revisiting the conditions of some of the trade agreements that the United States has entered, whether it was the North American Free Trade Agreement, whether it was the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is now basically a dead letter, or the World Trade Organization. I think what sets Mr. Trump apart from this is that he has a very strong and abiding desire to take high profile and direct action. He really, really likes the idea of tariffs. And he hasn't thought through, or at least he hasn't given much weight to the unintended consequences of when you do this. You raise tariffs on steel and aluminum. You make American steel and aluminum makers more competitive domestically, but you make any company that uses steel and aluminum less competitive. Maybe they lose jobs and have to lay people off. Maybe they lose sales abroad. And moreover, I think that there's a sort of a failure to understand how the trade agreements are meant to be sort of like mutually supportive. Take the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for example. The countries that entered into that agreement with the United States, like Japan, like Vietnam, they committed to lower tariffs more than the United States did. So that if you really cared about U.S. access to other markets, that agreement gave the United States more access than other countries had. And the final point is that this idea that you can start a trade war and you're the only person who's going to reach for your gun is really kind of naive. The whole point of a trade war is that if you fire, somebody's going to fire back. And when the United States imposes these tariffs, our trading partners are not going to sit still. They're not just going to take it. They have voters that are going to expect them to stand up to what is perceived as unfair action by the United States. And the first thing those countries will do is bring cases against the United States in the World Trade Organization, which is a quasi-judicial international dispute settlement organization. And if the United States cannot make a strong case that the tariffs it imposed complied with its own domestic laws and its international agreements, then those countries will get a green light to impose tariffs on the United States. Then what? Does Trump decide he must retaliate again by raising tariffs some more? I think that starts to get you into these worries about repeating some of the ugly episodes of the 1930s of tit-for-tat trade wars. I think personally that we're a long way from that. I think that our trading partners have a very strong interest in avoiding that. And I also think that there are a lot of people in the United States who want to avoid that, including members of Donald Trump's own party and members of his cabinet. We know from reporting that there's a lot of tension between what they call the globalist members of his cabinet, like Gary Cohn, the head of his National Economic Council, and the more nationalist elements, people like Peter Navarro, who's a trade advisor, or Wilbur Ross, the commerce secretary. And just because we've heard these announcements come out today, I don't think we can take it for granted that this is where the administration will always end up.
Robert Reich, did you have misgivings about the TPP? And if you did, was your answer to unilaterally pull out, as President Trump did, or to just fix what was wrong with it?
I did have concerns about the TPP, Ray. Specifically, the mechanism inside the TPP designed to deal with instances where companies felt that they were being harmed by a member nation and would therefore have an opportunity to go to an arbitrator, an arbitration board outside any country, and possibly get penalties imposed on that country for health, safety, environmental, labor, securities, any other kind of regulations that that board decided was a non-tariff barrier, was an unfair barrier to that company. That whole process seemed to me to be very dangerous, not only in terms of sovereignty, but also in terms of making it more difficult for the United States or any other country to generate and develop and pass, ultimately, health, safety, environmental, labor, or any other kinds of protections. But your question is, notwithstanding that, could it be fixed? I think that my inclination was to try to fix it, obviously. You don't want to throw out the entire TPP baby if you possibly can. There were very good things in it. But Donald Trump chose to throw it out.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Robert Reich and Greg Ipp. And gentlemen, so far we've talked about economics, we've talked about American external relations. I want to talk about the budget and budget proposals as political animals. This is a continent-sized country, home to, we're now pushing 330 million people. It's hard to imagine economic policies or proposals that would make all 330 million happy or even better off. As we look at today's House and Senate, not the House and Senate of dreams or wishes, but the one that really goes and sits in Washington, D.C., if you represent a district that includes a fading mill town in northeastern Massachusetts, a rural county in Nebraska, a Sunbelt suburban district in Arizona, you may have very different needs, very different perspectives on what's economically beneficial. Is there now, has there been, coherence in this process? We've been running on continuing resolutions. We've been unable to come to common cause using the normal political mechanisms when making budgets. Greg Ipp, when you look at this, well, mess, what needs to happen?
Well, I think you need to look at the tax and spending side separately. On the spending side, you're right. For years, this country has been, the Congress has been unable to put together a budget. But oddly enough, a few weeks ago, they did. They actually passed a two-year resolution with significant support from both sides of the aisle on what taxing and spending ought to be over the next 2 years, which is a reason why President Trump's budget was relatively insignificant, because the budget had already been set. Now, within those broad categories, decisions will still have to be made about whether this department gets this many dollars and that department gets that many dollars. But in an odd way, we actually seem to have arrived at a bit more coherence on the budget front than we have in a number of years. Now, partly that was because we put off all the hard decisions. We're running these large budget deficits because we don't want to cut anybody's spending or raise anybody's taxes. So the fact that we have a relatively calm and tranquil budget outlook for the near-term future should not at all be seen as evidence that we've reached final stability. There are going to be some really knock-down, drag-em-out fights in the next few years as we try and cope with these deficits. Now, looking at the tax side, I do actually have some sympathy for what you said, Ray, about whether this budget or whether these budget choices affect different parts of the country differently. One of the unusual aspects of the Republican tax plan that was eventually passed into law in late December, passed entirely along party lines. Now, it contained a lot of the things that Republicans have long wanted to do. They wanted to lower tax rates because they believe that's good for growth and encourages people to work. But they also wanted to eliminate some tax breaks, which they believe are wasteful and basically do not help economic growth. Well, on that front, most economists would say, yes, let's lower rates, let's eliminate some of these wasteful preferences and so forth, and we'll get the same taxes, the same system, and better economic growth. But that's not really what happened. They were only able to find enough tax breaks to pay for about two-thirds of their tax cuts, which is why we have a large deficit that results from that. And moreover, the only tax cut that they were able to come up with that was really significant in terms of saving money was a deduction for state and local taxes. And what's interesting about that is that that is a deduction whose benefits go disproportionately to blue states, Democratic states that generally pay higher state and local taxes. And that's not a coincidence. It really reflects a calculation, a political calculation by the Republican tax writing committees, that if somebody was going to pay a price for this tax reform, better that it not be their voters and their congressmen. I would not take it so much as a deliberate attempt to hurt the blue states, so much as it was a political calculation to try and put all the pain over on somebody else's voters. And I think that that was very unusual and somewhat unprecedented for tax policy in this country. And the reason it's significant is that one of the great problems we've had with budget policy in this country is that it's been very unstable insofar as a Republican president or Republican Congress comes in and passes a bunch of their priorities, and then the Democrats spend the next 4 to 8 years trying to undo them. And then when the Democrats take power, we just switch sides and the whole process begins again. And so by passing a tax bill on such partisan lines and that so specifically loads most of its costs onto Democratic voters, I think that this tax bill essentially guarantees that Democrats will spend the next 4 to 8 years trying to undo it. And that means that our fiscal framework remains very unstable.
Robert Reich, what do you think of Greg Ipp's political analysis?
Well, I think there's a lot to it. And I also believe that once you have a set of precedents for making tax policy that is as partisan as we've become, and this particular tax plan, now law, has been, then you are laying the groundwork for years and years of highly, highly partisan fiscal policy, tax policy specifically. You know, many people don't understand the reality of the blue state versus red state subsidy that's going on even before, that was happening even before this new tax law. And that is that the tax payments of citizens of blue states to Washington were much, much greater than what the citizens of blue states were getting back from Washington in the form of all sorts of government services. And it was just the reverse for red states. Red states' tax revenues sent to Washington were much less than red states were getting back from Washington in the form of services. So now, with this additional tax change, which prohibits many people, in fact, all of citizens in blue states from deducting their state and local taxes, you get an even larger lopsided subsidy, essentially, going from blue states to red states. And that is, I think Greg is exactly right. You've started now a kind of a vicious cycle that will express itself from year in, year out, in tax policy changes that's going to not only destabilize tax policy, but just open up another arena for partisan warfare.
You've been writing about, you've been talking about the common good. When you separate Americans in that way, Californians from Arkansans, are you actually pushing in the other direction? Shredding the common good, or at least our groping attempts toward getting to something like the common good?
We're not even talking very much about the common good, if at all, anymore, Ray. It used to be a commonly understood phrase. That is, when John F. Kennedy asked us to basically say, you know, not what America could do for us, but what we could do for America, he was urging Americans to think even more about our common needs. And that is what is in danger of disappearing. It's not just that people of California versus people of Arkansas are being put into separate kind of pitted against one another, but people inside California and inside Arkansas and basically every strata of America is being put against every other one. We've never seen the degree of inequality of income and wealth we have seen now. And yet, what does that mean? It means that very often, if you go down to the local level, we have schools that are dependent more and more on their local property taxes, and yet the entire city or the entire neighborhood or the entire town is either poor or rich, and that means that we are exacerbating inequality. And I could give you examples multiplied many, many times over of this same problem. You see, when more and more income and wealth concentrate at the top, the political reality for both Democrats and Republicans is that the moneyed interests have more and more power over budget policy and tax policy and regulatory policy and every other kind of policy. And this is not, I want to emphasize, Democrats versus Republicans. This is both sides. That is, Democrats, to a large extent, are drinking out of the same trough of campaign contributions, wealthy individuals, big corporations, Wall Street, as is the Republican Party. And no wonder that so many average Americans in the 2016 election said to pollsters and others that the game is rigged against them and that they were going to vote for somebody who was going to shake things up, whether that person was called named Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders.
Greg, do some of these choices operate on a symbolic plane, that they tell us something about what we think is important, but actually aren't really make or break to the revenue of the government and then how it turns around and spends that money? And I'm thinking of moving toward eliminating the estate tax, which was a big part of the recently concluded debate over how America runs its taxation. By saying that larger and larger fortunes can be handed on to heirs free of taxation, it's not something that's going to, you know, knock the economy off its bearings or change the fiscal outlook of the United States forever and a day now. But it does say something about what we think is important, how money moves around, what we think is just and fair. What was the message coming out of a Republican Congress working so hard to change the way rich people can hand on their estates?
Well, you're right. I mean, the symbolism of these things is often far more powerful politically than the actual dollar impact. And we see that over and over again in many different things. I mean, setting aside the estate tax for a moment, one of the few taxes that this tax bill raises is the tax on university endowments of above a certain size. Not coincidentally, most of those universities happen to be in blue states. They're like very well off liberal colleges, and a lot of Republicans harbor a lot of animosity towards them, as seeing them as basically institutions of liberal antagonism. And so that was a tax increase that the dollar value was trivial. It wasn't even, it would be flattering to call it a rounding error. And yet it was symbolically very powerful. It spoke to an important constituency in Republican ranks, you know, reducing civil service salaries. On the other hand, there has also been proposals to tax carried interest on hedge funds and the like. And in fact, I believe the Trump Treasury Department recently just passed administrative guidance that would try and limit the ability of hedge funds to escape taxation, to basically shelter their income from this sort of tax. But once again, very symbolic. The amount of money involved is very, very small. One of the interesting aspects of this round of tax discussions is that historically Republicans did try to cut all sorts of taxes, including those that were primarily to the benefit of a very small number of extremely wealthy households. And the most prominent example of that was the estate tax, a tax that is paid by only a I don't actually have the numbers at my fingertips, but the numbers are extremely small. They're very wealthy people. There are exemptions in place that protect the vast number of farmers and small businesses and households from the estate tax. And but it had been very symbolically important for Republicans for a long time to a very important part of their donor base that saw this as an unfair taxation at death on money that they had spent their lifetime trying to accumulate. The original Republican proposal did indeed get rid of the estate tax, but the final product did not. Another interesting thing is that the top rate paid by the wealthy only went down a percentage point. Now, it did go down, but it's still higher than where George W. Bush cut it to when he was president. And I think that's kind of interesting because it does speak to an interesting evolution within the Republican Party. There are elements of the Trump Republican Party that are a little less unambiguously supportive of helping out the rich in the area of taxes, that is aware that doing favors for rich people is essentially antagonizes and alienates a lot of the types of voters that they're trying to get, working class voters in blue-collar areas, professions, states, and so on. Steve Bannon, a very controversial alt-right advisor to Trump who got basically pushed out some months ago, used to make this point. He thought Trump should raise taxes on the rich in order to sort of like assert that alliance or that bond to the working class voter. So I think in the case of the Republican Party, what you're watching is a little bit of evolution and some growing pains between these traditional views, which is basically let's tax everybody less, but especially the rich because they already pay the most taxes, and a more populist, nationalist approach under Trump and some of his advisors. And it'll be interesting to see how this continues to evolve. But just looking at the sheer dollar impact, you just can't escape the hard, simple truth that the rich did extremely well out of this tax bill.
But Robert Reich, it sounds from what Greg said that there are at least still two sides pulling on either end of the rope. There is still a tug of war.
Inside the White House and inside the Republican Party, I think there certainly is a tug of war. There's also a similar tug of war inside the Democratic Party. You've got the establishment Democrats who are moving to the putative center, as the center used to be defined. And you've got the anti-establishment Democrats who really do view economic populism and the widening gap in income and wealth as the central problem of American democracy right now. It wouldn't be surprising to me if we saw, not necessarily by 2020, but certainly evolving over the next 10 years, not a third party, but something the equivalent of a third party. That is, there's so many anti-establishment Republicans who are against what they call crony capitalism, big money in politics. And similarly with the Democratic Party, anti-establishment Democrats who use slightly different words but are also against essentially crony capitalism, think big money should be out of our system. They would be, if they ever align themselves with one another, a very, very powerful and perhaps very persuasive interest group.
Robert Reich is the former Secretary of Labor of the United States, an author, a professor, and occasionally a cartoonist and short filmmaker. Good to talk to you, Robert Reich.
Ray, good to talk to you.
And Greg Ipp is an economics commentator for The Wall Street Journal. Greg Ipp, a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Please visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Robert Reich. He's the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and he's the former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. He was joined by Greg Ipp. He's the Chief Economics Commentator for the Wall Street Journal, and the program was moderated by Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.